This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the Supreme Court will have to rule again on gay marriage way sooner than John Roberts wants to. Also, can Massachusetts ban abortion protesters from any place near abortion clinics? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, The Spoils of Babylon, an epic parody of the soapy 1970s melodramatic miniseries. Then, what should we make of the fact that not one African-American singer had a number one hit song last year? And then, True Detective, HBO's atmospheric new crime drama.
I can see your soul at the edges of your eyes. You got a demon, little man.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Something deep and dark, detectives. Something deep and dark.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Utah marriage equality case that's putting the Supreme Court in a bind. And then, will the Supreme Court throw out Massachusetts' limits on abortion clinic protests? And of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hi, John.
Hello.
And from New Haven, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The back and forth over Utah's marriage laws. It rivals the last 2 minutes of an NFL playoff game. Gay marriage was banned in Utah. Then a federal judge ruled the ban unconstitutional and allowed marriages. He refused to grant a stay that would have held up those marriages. So gay people in Utah began to get legally married. Then a federal appeals court also didn't step in. And finally, the U.S. Supreme Court stayed the marriages until the 10th Circuit, the appeals court, could issue a decision. Then the question became, the 1,300 couples that got married in Utah during this period, are they legally married or not? Utah announced it wasn't recognizing the 1,300 marriages, but Eric Holder, the attorney general, announced that the federal government would. Phew, pretty complicated. And also something similar is happening in Oklahoma and a little bit in Ohio. So, Emily, it appears that marriage equality, which had a big moment in 2013, and everyone thought, okay, now it's just going to kind of ride through the states. There's going to be little by little by little, the culture is clearly changing. It's all moving in that direction, and it's going to gradually, we're going to have a kind of dominoes falling across the country. I don't think anyone expected the domino to be Utah or Oklahoma. How is it that this is moving so quickly, and is it going to end up back at the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's funny because now in retrospect, it seems obvious that some, you know, democratically appointed judge in a red state would make this kind of ruling. Because when you look at Windsor, the Supreme Court ruling last year or last term that held the Defense of Marriage Act unconstitutional, all the seeds are there. It has all this lofty language about equality and dignity in it. And while that case was about really giving deference to state law, if you take the principles of dignity and equality and then you apply it to states that have banned gay marriage, you have a problem. So now we have these two rulings from these conservative states. They will both go up to the federal appeals court that is the 10th Circuit, not an especially liberal court. But to me, the most interesting wrinkle in all of this is that the 10th Circuit asked to temporarily stop the Utah judge's order from going into effect and halt all these gay marriages that were happening around the state, said, you know what? No, we're not going to stop it. And the standard for deciding whether to stop it, one of the important parts of it is, do you think that Utah is going to succeed on the merits in winning its case, upholding its ban on gay marriage? So if the 10th Circuit goes along with these district court judges and gay marriage is approved to, well, not just begin in Utah, but to continue throughout the states that the 10th Circuit presides over, that is going to be a pretty seismic shift. And it's really hard to imagine the Supreme Court just kind of letting that happen. Although, I suppose they could wait until they have a split with another appellate court, which surely would play out eventually in the next couple of years.
So a 10th Circuit ruling that upheld the district court's ruling would say it is unconstitutional to ban same-sex marriage, therefore same-sex marriage, there's marriage equality is legal all across the 10th Circuit. Every ban that exists, whether it's in Utah, but also
Oklahoma
is
Utah.
Gone. So these very conservative states suddenly would have gay
marriage for real. I mean, the Supreme Court could stay that order again, but essentially you would then be having an appeals court weigh in, and that is the moment when the Supreme Court would be very tempted to get involved. I mean, usually the Supreme Court waits for what's called a circuit split when you have two federal appeals courts go in different directions. I don't think we'd have long to wait for a circuit split because I cannot see any way that the Fifth Circuit, which is the one that includes Texas and is really conservative, I just do not see them going along with this.
Emily, how do we get to a situation where it seems possible that the Supreme Court, which said in the Windsor decision, basically states have a right to make their own that marriage is a state function, get from that to interpreting the Windsor decision to say actually what it means is, yes, marriage is a state function, but in fact the kind of dignity and rights of gays to marry is more important. And therefore, it's not really a state function. Marriage isn't a state function. It is, in fact, a constitutional right. How does something which explicitly kind of didn't make it marriage a constitutional right suddenly become a decision that makes marriage a constitutional right?
Well, I think this is the fascinating ambiguity in Justice Anthony Kennedy's opinion in Windsor. I think he was saying two
things. And Windsor is the defense of
marriage.
The Windsor is the one that threw out the Defense of Marriage Act.
Right. And you can read his majority opinion in Windsor two ways. You can give a lot of primacy to the idea that states get to define marriage and the federal government just follows along. Or you can give a lot of primacy to human dignity and equality and the kind of moments at which Kennedy flicks at what seems to me very much previewing an eventual Supreme Court decision holding marriage equality to be true throughout the land. I mean, I don't think Justice Kennedy meant to do more than sort of, you know, wink at that idea right now. But you have this moment, which these district court judges are having a good time citing, where Justice Scalia essentially predicted marriage equality everywhere as the, for to him, deplorable result of Windsor. And now these judges are sort of taking up that opportunity.
John, as a matter of politics, do you think if judges end up making legal decisions that render marriage equality the law in Oklahoma and Utah and states that affirmatively voted against marriage equality, that like passed constitutional amendments banning it or laws banning it.
Years ago, but they passed them,
and there's still majorities.
But
I mean, I can't imagine there's a majority in Oklahoma.
Well, actually, the polls in Utah are shifting fast, according to a recent poll. But yes, go ahead. You're still right.
Do you think this becomes a political issue? I mean, so far, the marriage equality issue has been, in the last couple of years, it's clearly been something that Democrats have aligned themselves with and conservatives have basically been getting out of the way. But if it becomes a thing where states' rights, where judges are really stomping on state laws and state constitutional amendments, do you see there being a backlash?
You've seen the Republican Party stay away from this issue in fundraising, in outraging. I mean, you've seen the evolution already from Hillary Clinton, from President Obama, move quickly within the Democratic Party. In the Republican Party, there's been a pretty fast evolution, too, which is that they haven't raised money or tried to make political hay of this. You remember in 2004 when President Bush was trying to get reelected, he called a special press conference in the Roosevelt Room to announce that he was putting forward an amendment to the Constitution to ban same-sex marriage. That was a completely confected event in order to – it was a twofer. One, it was to complain about the judges in Massachusetts and also to raise money, win support from those who don't like same-sex marriage. Now that doesn't – that avenue doesn't exist. But when you throw judges in there, when you throw unelected – these are unelected judges, Emily?
Yes.
They are unelected, those federal judges. They're appointed
by the
president.
Sorry, I'm thinking about the state judges. You know, when you have unelected judges – thwarting the will of the people, some candidate's going to pick this up and come at it from that angle. But I think as a long-term issue in the Republican primary, I think you're going to have one candidate, probably Rick Santorum, who will go after this. It'll be interesting to watch that play out, but I don't think it's a big moneymaker for the Republican candidates.
It's a big loser.
Emily, if this gets to the Supreme Court, do you see it possible that the Supreme Court actually turns its back on marriage equality and says, this is a state function. We are not going to get into it. What Kennedy said is, you know, it's fine that he's for all for dignity, but we're going to leave it up to states to make this decision. We just don't want a part of it. Which direction do you think they're likely to go? Because you obviously have four justices who are strongly for marriage equality, three who are strongly against, and then Roberts and Kennedy seem to be the straddles.
Don't put Roberts in the middle. He's not in the middle. He's
okay,
on the opposing 4-4.
Side. So it's Kennedy. Is Kennedy willing, with judges making decisions, is he willing to say this is not a state function? This is, in fact, a constitutional right. Everything's moving this direction. Let's get it done.
I think that Kennedy will come through for gay marriage in that scenario. I think it would be a lot easier on him or whoever replaces him if 5 years, even 3 years, passed between now and then, and the total of states that have gotten to marriage equality on their own really starts to, you know, once we have 25, 30 states, that's a lot easier than where we're at right now, which I think is 17, if you don't include Utah, or maybe 18 plus the District of Columbia. It will be just be easier on all of them. But I just don't think Anthony Kennedy turns his back on this cause. It's like the big civil rights cause he has gone for. He thinks he has created all this law on his own, and he kind of has. I mean, he should have cited some other decisions along the way to make it less the case, but I just think this is his legacy and he's
going
to run
with it. Don't you guys kind of think, like, we just need to get over this whole issue? Just, like, let's just get – it's obviously going to be the national law. Let's just get it done. Liberals can stop feeling so smug.
No, I don't think
Liberals
that.
Are so smug about it. They're so self-righteous. Like, we're for marriage equality. We've been – and, yes, you're on the right side of the issue, but it's obviously just going to happen. So let's do it and then get on to issues that – other issues that matter where there's a real fight, like issues around inequality or issues around race or poverty or education, where the stakes are higher and there's not such a clear right answer and a clear victory in sight.
Well, I don't think any of that. I mean, I'm all for talking about those other issues. And Dahlia Lithwick, our colleague, and Barry Friedman wrote a really interesting piece making, I think, your argument last year, David, if I'm remembering right. But I think, first of all, that this is legitimate civil rights issue that deserves the attention it's getting. And second of all, I'm really in favor of it playing out regionally and people in states that where the rates of opposition are still high. I think if you give them time, they will come to this on their own and that's actually a really important process.
Well, so then shouldn't you not want Justice Kennedy to have to deal with the case?
Yeah, I'm in favor of it waiting 3 years. I have never been in a huge hurry about it for that reason. It's not that I don't appreciate the problems of discrimination. I just think that real political lasting change gets made in a lot more enduring a way if people come to it on their own. And I honestly think what's going to happen in Utah is those 1,300 people who got married are going to make change because people see married gay couples and they get used to the idea and it is so not a big deal. And it's when you know people, when you see it in your school, in your church, in your family, that you change your mind.
Last question, Emily. The state of Utah does not recognize these marriages at the moment. The federal government in the form of Eric Holder does recognize these marriages. Is that a big deal that there's a disagreement about that?
Well, I mean, look, if you are one of these couples, you are essentially enduring a social experiment. One is being basically performed on you, where you have one reality for your federal tax forms, another reality for state benefits. Yes, it is going to matter to individual people that they are being treated differently. And in some cases, it's going to cause problems. I also think, though, that every time we read about some crazy legal entanglement that somebody's in and the problem of not being on your partner's death certificate or whatever it is, that we get a little more sensitized to what it means to not have this kind of equality.
Coming up, the Supreme Court asks how close protesters can get to abortion clinics in Massachusetts. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. The Supreme Court this week heard arguments in a case about whether Massachusetts laws about protesting outside an abortion clinic are constitutional. The Massachusetts keeps protesters 35 feet away from clinics. And the court faced a claim from some of these protesters who said that's a constraint on free speech. We ought to be allowed to be right up at the door, as long as it's public property, as long as we're not committing violence. We're simply using our speech to persuade people who are going to the abortion clinic that they're making a mistake. We ought to be allowed to be 0 feet away. So it sounds like the court was very sympathetic to the protesters' arguments, Emily.
Yeah. I mean, the slight confusion here was that Chief Justice John Roberts and Clarence Thomas didn't speak. So I guess you could count them as question marks. I don't think they're question marks. I think that this 35-foot buffer zone is not long for this world. And, you know, I'm torn about this. I think there's a problem with this law constitutionally because it doesn't only apply to protesters who are doing something that you would consider harassment or physical intimidation. In fact, there are other laws that address those problems. And so when you apply a law like this to people like the lead plaintiff, who is this like picture-perfect grandmother with a stroller, she is just trying to talk women peacefully out of having their abortions. And so essentially to say that she can't go into this 35-foot buffer zone, but people who are escorting the patients in who support abortions can go in. I mean, that's just discriminating against her based on her point of view. I just don't know how else to read the law. I would like to come up with some way to defend this law because I do think there's a legitimate problem of harassment. And Massachusetts has a scary history of violence here. There were two shootings in 1994 in which abortion providers and staff members were killed. So I feel that, and I also understand the emotional difficulties it causes women to be essentially lambasted or even just, in some cases, spoken to by people who are objecting to their decision as they're walking in the door. But, you know, we live in a country where people have the right to speak peacefully, and if that's all they're doing, I just don't see how they can be kept back from the entrance.
Wow. Emily Bazelon
represents. Which is too bad because I was planning to
have I don't even know what I'm going to talk about. Now I feel like we've played out the topic. John.
And it doesn't pose a problem of if you get rid of this law, then you suddenly let back in all the, you know, opportunities for more violent. I mean, so there are laws in the books that say you can't, you know, shoot people going into a abortion clinic. But what is there on the books that keeps you from those scenes where it's a gauntlet you have to run?
Right. So you can't obstruct an entrance and you can't physically harass or intimidate anyone. I mean, John, that's completely the key question that you just asked. So the argument for keeping this law in place is that prosecutions after the fact don't work. They don't address the damage that's being done in the moment. And also
what
that
is the damage
the reason
that's being done?
Why.
I mean, there's damage if you can't get in the clinic, but not that if you can't claim there's damage if someone is being psychologically harangued.
Well, why not?
Why not?
You don't have a right not to be
psych- to claim emotional
But you do not
trauma.
Have a right not to have people yell nasty things at you.
Ah, but in fact, in 2000, when the Supreme Court upheld a similar law in Colorado, Justice John Paul Stevens said for the majority that he was concerned in this particular locale about the potential for emotional trauma. And he also talked about how the unwilling listener has a right to be left alone. That is current law. I don't actually think it's a very steady reading of the First Amendment as we now have it with this current court, which is super absolutist about the First Amendment, but it's on the books.
If you are in a public place and someone is not, say, they're not using amplified speech, they're not blocking your way, why can't they speak at you?
Well, the argument is that it's a reasonable time, place, and manner regulation, that in the same way the government can stop people from blaring loudspeakers at 2 a.m. across the street from your house, in the context of the fraught, chaotic natures of the entrances to abortion clinics with all of the potential for violence and political protest that goes on there, that they can have special rules. The same way we have special rules, in fact, in some states, outside of slaughterhouses, in places where workers go on strike. And actually now we have these rules preventing protesters from going within 300 feet of a military funeral.
Can we do? Wait, but that's a congressional law.
Yeah, Congress passed that law in 2012.
The Supreme Court will throw that out, probably.
No, I don't think that's constitutional.
Yeah, the Supreme Court will get, because the Supreme Court had a decision which allowed protesters at military funerals, right?
So the law, the 2012 law, is a response to that decision in 2011, which said that the family of a deceased soldier could not sue for emotional distress.
Could one remedy be that you have a very minor little process that your grandmothers can go through to sort of apply for a permit to be
a permit to give speech?
No,
just
no,
for, permit
no.
For speech?
In the special case here. That
it's
you,
not a crazy
that, you
idea.
That you are given, you're kind of cleared to do this so that it doesn't become the circus
that's,
that they obviously
that's,
decided
that's
they
a prior restraint. Emily, I thought you wrote a piece about this. I thought you made a brilliant point, which I'm now going to make for you.
Let's talk about that some more. Though I don't think John's idea is crazy because these protesters slash demonstrators are repeat players. So the idea that some of them could show that
Getting
they're peaceful,
license,
I mean, it'll never happen.
Free speech
but
in this country
it's not a
is
crazy
a terrible idea.
Idea.
So. But Emily's great idea was, yes, these free speech restrictions on abortion clinics are bad. It's terrible to treat abortion clinics as a separate space for free speech. I'm exaggerating your argument here. But if that's the case, then let's stop treating them specially when it comes to the anti-abortion restrictions, like where you pretend they are more profound medical establishments than they are. You impose all sorts of licensing restrictions on them. You impose all sorts of particular demands on them in terms of what the attending physicians have to be able to do, how wide the corridors are. So they shouldn't do that, just as we shouldn't have special laws that restrict free speech at a clinic. You should also shouldn't have these bogus non-medical things that they're doing.
Hey, Emily,
that was a terrible explanation.
Don't look. It's a good argument, though.
No, that was a good explanation.
Don't localities require permits for things like the playing of public music and for like selling, like the guys who sell street scents in Washington?
Yes.
Don't they have to get a permit?
Yeah, those are reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions in public spaces. They have to be viewpoint neutral. The problem with this law is it's really hard, I think, to make the argument that it's viewpoint neutral. right? Oh, polling places. We also don't let people talk right. within polling places, but it applies to everybody. It's bipartisan.
But I guess the point is, for my modification here, I was looking for precedent in existing law for permits.
We only license speech in the ways of like giving permits for parades and demonstrations when it's viewpoint neutral. Once you have any kind of glimmer of discrimination on the basis of what the content of someone's saying, the courts
get very
nervous.
What if I'm singing protest songs?
That's good. You can sing protest songs.
That's right. You can do the Gordon Lightfoot. But once you start getting into Ani DiFranco, we're going to throw a tarp over your ass.
Really where it comes down to is like that a lot of the time the authorities will say we are viewpoint neutral. But then other people say, well, you're not really viewpoint neutral because the only people who would want these kind of permits are people who have a view that's oppositional to you.
Right. And that's the classic civil libertarian ACLU argument against these licensing requirements. Interestingly, the ACLU came down on the side of the state of Massachusetts and the abortion clinics in this case, which reversed its previous position. And their argument is that there are competing rights here. Yes, there are First Amendment rights, but there also is the constitutional right women have to get an abortion. My problem with that is that actually, women still get to go into the clinics. Like, it would be one thing if someone was blocking their actual entrance, but I'm not sure that you can argue that the emotional impact of someone asking you to think again and change your mind is really obstructing you.
All right. Cocktail chatter, the one thing you must discuss this weekend. John.
So the president of France, François Hollande, doesn't have a wife, but he has what's known as the first girlfriend. But the problem is he also has a girlfriend, who's a French actress. This put the French president, whose approval ratings are below 20, in the difficult position of being unable to answer the question, who is the first lady, at his annual beginning of the year press conference. But one of my favorite quotes from one of the reports was a CBS report in which a French woman is very exercised, and she said, the elite French, the educated French, it's totally humiliating to them. They feel like they're living in Italy, and that's not very funny. So when you're really down and you're French and you're feeling like you've really lost your old sense of national centeredness and pride, you feel like you're like living
Italians,
in Italy.
When Italians think their government is being too rinky-dink, what do they compare themselves to?
Who do they look down on? I don't know.
Emily, what is your chatter?
Well, the Supreme Court also heard a challenge this week to the president's power to make recess appointments when the Senate is not between sessions, but rather taking a break in the middle of a session. And so what really interested me about this argument was that presidents have been doing this forever. I mean, Obama ramped it up a little because his Senate is so obstructionist. But honestly, there's like hundreds of these appointments that have been made. And yet the Supreme Court, in a pretty bipartisan, most of them way, just seemed to be saying, wait a second, this is not what the Constitution says. And where in here does it say that the framers were worried about the proper functioning of government? And so it was as if decades of history and this kind of pragmatic, prudential argument for just allowing this to continue was just all going to be swept away. It's really interesting.
My chatter. So Robert Gates, the former Defense Secretary, has a new memoir. It's called Duty. I have not read it, I must confess, but I've read a lot about it. And after describing in some detail a National Security Council meeting on what to do if Israel attacked Iran, Gates writes, quote, I was put off by the way the president closed the meeting. To his closest advisors, he said, for the record, and for those of you writing your memoirs, I am not making any decision about Israel or Iran. Joe Biden, you be my witness. Then Gates writes, I was offended by Obama's suspicion that any of us would ever write about such sensitive matters. Yet there he is writing exactly about these sensitive matters. It's like this kind of weird blind spot. I don't even understand what his explanation for it. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, True Detective is a sinuous and cunning new show from HBO starring Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And then IFC, Will Ferrell, and Funny or Die team up for The Spoils of Babylon, a parody of the old 70s miniseries. And finally, we discuss the startling absence of black performers at the top of 2013's Billboard charts with the music critic Chris Melanthi.
Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
You look like you slept for two straight months. Man, you're just glowing.
I'd call it 7 hours, but I'll take it.
Exactly. New parent speak right there. And then, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve. I look like I slept for 2.5 hours, which I did.
That's a reverse Cavell there. Oh, man, that's tough. All right, well, why don't we dig in right away with True Detective? It's the new HBO series. It stars, as I said, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as a couple of Louisiana cops trying to solve a murder. The twist in the show is that it toggles back and forth between 1995, when theirs was a hot case, to 2012, when it's gone quite cold. The twist about the show is that its creator is a novelist and a professor of literature, as I understand it, kind of amazing. Before we tuck in, let's listen to a clip.
You're not a Christian, so what do you believe?
I believe that people shouldn't talk about this type of shit at work.
Hold on. 3 months we've been together, I get nothing from you. Today, what we're into now, do me a courtesy, okay? I'm not trying to convert you.
Look, I'd consider myself a realist, all right? But in philosophical terms, I'm what's called a pessimist.
Okay, what's that mean?
It means I'm bad at parties.
Let me tell you, you ain't great outside of parties either.
All right, well, Dana, just a tiny bit of background before you tell me whether you liked or didn't like it. This show is sort of, it's been called an anthology, which I find a very interesting concept, which is that its creator is a guy named Nick Palazzotto, the novelist that I referred to in the intro to the segment. So what they're going to do is they're going to have Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson as these two detectives working on this crime for a 6 or 8 episode run. That storyline is going to come to an end. Nick Palazzotto sticks around for a second season. No one else does. It's a new story, a new set of detectives. Nice, I think, really interesting format. It's going to refresh itself over and over again in theory. What did you think of this show?
Well, I think I went in thinking that the concept was going to be a little bit tired, honestly. We've talked about this before, how, you know, the new format of the cable show has become the dark, mysterious hero, the crime procedural. You know, there has to be a body that's splayed in some horrific way and people sitting around studying it. And that happens early in the first episode, the pilot of this 8-episode run, in a way that felt over familiar and a little bit creepy to me. You know, it's like that Edgar Allan Poe sentence about the most fit subject for literature is a beautiful dead woman or something like that.
I mean,
like, TV procedurals believe that. So at such a deep and disturbing level that there's nothing we want to see more than, you know, some dead prostitute in some awful position with a bunch of men taking notes on it. And so that sort of creeped me out at the beginning of the show. Also, it's a show that starts off sort of ponderous and slow. And that clip that we heard might make it sound as if, you know, there's a lot of very heavy, macho, blustering dialogue. But in fact, about halfway through the first episode, I started to be won over by the relationship between these two cops, by the performances of Harrelson and McConaughey, who are both great, and by this weird dark humor that runs through the pilot, especially in those car scenes when they're kind of bantering together in this leaden way and trying to get a buddy cop relationship off the ground that never happens, mainly because the McConaughey character is just so extremely weird. And if I stick with the show, it will be because of the mystery of that character, not because of the mystery of what happened to the naked girl with antlers tied to her head.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Julia, what do you think about the show?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cheat. One of the creators of the show, I think, said in an interview, I couldn't be the least bit interested in naked dead women or procedurals. To me, this is all a character study, and I'm so interested in these characters.
It's so cynical to make
like,
that kind
okay,
of show.
Okay, well, so, like, set it in a, you know, muffin factory or something. Like, why, you know, you are building up a lot of propulsive story energy and dread because of the dead woman. So just, like, own it. You needed the dead woman. You put the dead woman in. Like, don't be all like, oh, you know, I don't really care about corpses. It's not trying to be gory. It's like you're not trying to be gory. We're just, like, staring at the blue, long, dead, naked woman for, like, epic scenes.
That makes it even worse because that just makes it the default mode. Oh, gotta have a dead, naked woman. Throw her in there, whether
yeah.
you care or not.
So there's a little bit of that. However, I'm super excited to keep watching this show. I thought it was so fun, and I think it's entirely about the charm of these two actors who just seem like, after years of kind of flopping about lackadaisically, they are on point and hitting their strides, and the just sheer virtuosity is so fun to bask in. As for whether this show turns out to be you know, kind of one of the upper echelon great TV shows or just one of the super hyper competent really fun to watch TV shows, I'm not sure where it's going to land, and maybe I'd point a little bit more toward the latter, just in a gut level guess from the pilot, because I think the propulsive energy is just like, you know, what's going to happen? Who really did it? Who did the murder? Like, those are the searching questions of the show.
Mm-hmm.
They're suspense questions. They're mystery questions.
Right.
But how enjoyable.
Right. And there's evidence that the creator may be less interested in those questions than the creator of another TV show might be. And I completely loved, adored, total infatuation first pilot episode that we watched. However, I was very disappointed to see Julia on exactly this point, that the New York Times critic who had had access to the first four episodes says that it falls into an artsy stasis, which for me is okay because about 20 years ago I fell into an artsy stasis and never got out of it. So I'll cut it some slack. But I honestly am starting to think that an American actor has not been on the kind of win streak that Matthew McConaughey is on now for, you know, you don't want to go back to Nicholson in the 70s because that's just entering the realm of hyperbole. But he is doing work that no one would have anticipated from this guy. And on such a level, he is up there now to me with, you know what you're going to see from Philip Seymour Hoffman every time you see him in a movie. You know you're going to see something absolutely superlative and novel. And you're now getting that from, get your head around it, you're now getting it from Matthew McConaughey. It's almost as surprising as saying you're now getting it from the, you know, actress who starred as Blossom. You know, it's
hey, like, don't knock Maya Bialik.
I knew you would know it. Oh, my God. I like, threw it out there like I was trout fishing. And you
bloop, 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 bloop.
You bit. But anyway,
I disagree with the analogy to Blossom. I mean, I think that Matthew McConaughey had a period of choosing projects badly and, you know, being cast as this romantic lead that he clearly wasn't comfortable in. But I think he always had that weirdness and that promise. And way back in the Richard Linklater.
Well, that's what I remember.
Dazed and Confused, you know, I mean, he had that kind of combination of comedy and menace. The actor that he's often compared to is Robert Mitchum. And I think you really, really see that in this role. Isn't it a very Mitchum-like role in True Detective?
Oh, yeah, that's a great. I mean, I love the before and after, too. But Dana, let's talk a little bit about novels on TV. One of the things that people, I think, sort of forget about The Wire because it's so correctly associated with its creator, David Simon, is that they also brought in Richard Price, George Pelicanos, and help me out, Dennis Lehane, mm-hmm. to write, I would think, of a lion's share of the episodes, i.e. three of the truly great American crime novelists going. I think the marriage between working novelists who've done serious work in that medium moving to TV to produce what really are novels on TV, not just miniseries, is a great thing for American pop culture. What do you think, Dana?
Yeah, it seems like this Nick Pizzolatto, the showrunner and creator, not the director of the first season, but the, you know, the writer of the episodes, is something in between a literary novelist and a noir fiction crime type novelist. And he really, really shines at writing dialogue, which is not an easy thing to do. And the scene that first won me over, the one that kind of braids together, you know, the grim glimpse of what the McConaughey character's lonely, obsessive, drunken life is like with, you know, this kind of humorous banter between the two of them is just hilarious. It's beautifully written. You can quote it back to me because you were saying it before we taped about, I smell air.
I smell aluminum and ash. You can really sense the psychosphere. Something like that.
That's awesome. And then the way the Harrelson character shuts it down, like, when you come over to my house for dinner, you better not be talking any of that bullshit.
Yeah, which is why they get away with having one character be so pretentious as the other one is taking the piss out of him. It's done incredibly well. They're both doing great work. It's a pleasure to watch. All right. Well, anyway, the show is True Detective. It stars Woody Harrelson, Matthew McConaughey. It's on HBO. Check it out and report back to us what you think. Coming up, why have the Billboard charts become so lily white? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, while you're there, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right. Well, The Spoils of Babylon is an IFC television show. It's created by former Saturday Night Live writers under the aegis of the great Will Ferrell, wonderful Will Ferrell, and his website, Funny or Die. It is, Julia, to me, a slightly obscurely directed parody in the sense that it's the object of its satire are 1970s miniseries, specifically the one everyone name checks when they write about the show, The Thornbirds. So something kind of overblown, star-studded, and filled with kind of ridiculous melodrama. It stars Tobey Maguire. Will Ferrell appears, I think, wonderfully as the author of the book that the miniseries is based on and also its creator and director. Kristen Wiig, Tim Robbins, Val Kilmer. So they got a lot of star power to come out for this bizarre, I think, slightly unexpected romp. Did you like it?
Did I like it? I did not like it. It was fine. It was a little bit inert, right? I mean, there's a convening power that Will Ferrell has in the comedy community that he does not always use for maximal good. It seems like it would be really fun to be a comic actor working today and to get the nod from Will Ferrell, like, we're doing this crazy thing for IFC. Come on down. Val Kilmer, have a bit part as a general. You'll get to chomp a pipe and say a couple dirty things, and it'll be great, you know. And everybody does it, which is marvelous. But I feel like that's my primary response to things like this is like, wow, I can't believe they got everybody to show up and do this. Like, it feels like a bunch of friends putting on like a skit in the backyard, and the ideal intended audience would be a bunch of other people who were there for the production and are all kind of drunk and are like, you know, and you kind of don't get the joke if you weren't there. I had this feeling also, you know, watching Anchorman 2, which I went and saw over the holiday break, as I'm sure you did as well, Steve. And, you know, they have, just as Anchorman 1 culminates with a battle royale among news teams, there is a counterpoint scene in this movie where they just, like, lard on big celebrity names, additional celebrity, additional comic celebrity, doing nothing, having no purpose, where the sheer weight, cosmic mass of the comedic talent and firepower is the thing that's most impressive about the scene rather than how they are deployed. And that was the feeling I had about this.
Right. Well, this is a big question with the show. I ran into our friend and ex-colleague Jody Rosen on the subway this morning. We talked about the show. He loves it. And the reason he loves it is he was very familiar, being of a certain age, with what it's satirizing, which is this great, quote-unquote, era of miniseries beginning with Roots in the 70s and on to the Thornbirds and Shogun and all that. He grew up on that. I grew up on that. I kind of get what it's satirizing. Who else, aside from us, gets what it's satirizing? I don't. And why now? I mean, it's such a bizarre thing to decide to resurrect it for the purposes of crucifying. I don't know what metaphor you want to use, but Dana, what do you think of that?
I guess, I mean, I think I'm with Jody. I have a weakness for this kind of thing, genre parody, genre spoof, I guess you would call it, sort of, you know, visually and musically accurate spoofs of forms from bygone eras. And in a way, the more antiquarian and unrelated to current trends in entertainment, the better. For example, I think I was one of the four critics in the country who liked Casa de mi Padre, the fake Spanish language B-movie that Will Ferrell and Adam McKay, his collaborator who also worked on this series, made a couple years ago. It was this absolutely absurd, completely Spanish language, deliberately cheap-looking, fake Mexican melodrama. And Will Ferrell just spoke badly accented Spanish the entire time. And I loved it because it had no reason to exist, and it seemed like great fun to put together, and a lot of care was put into the detail, as is the case with this documentary as well. I mean, it looks crappy, but it looks very precisely crappy, and the sort of bad fake models of the little cars driving down the highway, and then we cut to Tobey Maguire inside this, you know, toy car that he couldn't possibly be inside. That stuff, it's goofy, it's ridiculous, but it's a 22-minute show. I mean, it makes me laugh.
Yes, it is good that it's a half hour and not an hour.
I just feel like there are worse ways to spend your comedy 22 minutes than on The Spoils of Babylon.
Certainly, I, you know, if I were, like, in a tunnel and someone turned it on, I wouldn't turn it off and stare at the blank wall instead.
It's great. It's, like, great in its own weird way, but not, you know, if I were accidentally buried alive with an iPhone and Wi-Fi and had 22 minutes of air, this might not be it.
So that's the tunnel plus scenario.
Yes,
it's good for the tunnel, not for the crypt.
So in other words, to champion the show, I have to say that it would be the thing that I would do with my last 22 minutes of oxygen.
I am only speaking for myself, Dana. How you wish to shuffle off that coil is your business.
Can I take this moment to comment upon an accidental synchronicity between two of our topics this week?
Always.
So one thing that we're seeing in television right now is the rise of the miniseries, right? The rise of the miniseries has actually been one of the super exciting things about the current micro moment of the larger television renaissance we're living in, right? And yet, this show is making fun of the spoils and excess of the previous miniseries moment. So I guess my question is, when does True Detective flip over into something that Will Ferrell will then make fun of? Like, so it seems like we need the bridge piece in between or something.
We'll have to revisit that in a GabFest in 2024 to see how long the reappropriation cycle has taken.
And if I'm not still on the show, then I do hope that I'm mistakenly buried alive with an iPhone with Wi-Fi and only 22 minutes of oxygen so I can listen to that segment.
All segments will be 22 minutes long in 2024.
And we'll make being buried alive worthwhile.
All right.
Good. All right. The show is The Spoils of Babylon. It's on IFC, I think, on Thursday nights. It's courtesy of Will Ferrell and Funny or Die. Check it out. Tell us what you thought. Leroy Jones, also known as Amira Baraka, died this past week. In the media reports of his passing, he was routinely described as controversial for many good reasons, I think. But one uncontroversial fact about him, Blues People, Negro Music in White America, his book about exactly what the title describes, is a kind of masterpiece. And in it, he says, the only so-called popular music in this country of any real value is of African derivation. Fast forward to 2013. With that in mind, I noted the following factoid. Not one black act topped the Hot 100 all year. So writes Chris Malamphy, a Slate contributor, a pop chart analyst, and music critic. Chris, welcome to the show. You say, I mean, so the factoid, that factoid alone is remarkable, but let's put it in some context. A, that's, as you say, never happened once before in the chart's 55-year history.
Right.
And you also say it's a huge pendulum swing in less than a decade. And as you point out, in 2004, literally every song that topped the Hot 100 was by a person of color. What happened? How'd we get here?
I think if I can give a nice, tight, short answer, the answer is digital happened. Basically, the charts of 10 years ago were very driven by radio airplay. And that's really the bulk of it. There was an iTunes store 10 years ago. It was invented in 2003, but it didn't factor into the charts yet because it was too new. And there was no YouTube, literally. And none of these things were factored into the charts. So you had a very top-down Hot 100 that was very driven by radio airplay. And then starting in 2005, Billboard understandably began factoring in iTunes and other digital sales into the Hot 100. And the charts didn't change immediately, but gradually, you started to see that songs that previously might not have been released as singles, might not have immediately gone to radio, were doing well, and the consumer had a more viral way of sharing songs. This worked just fine for hits of all stripes, both hip-hop and pop. So, you know, everyone from Kanye West to Gwen Stefani would have big hits that sold very well at iTunes. And then about a year ago, and this was a big move, they added YouTube to the chart. So if you watch a music video, that counts for the Hot 100. As these things were added to the chart, the aggregation of all that data seemed to favor songs by, to put it bluntly, white artists, more straightforward pop. And so you began to see this swing away from hip-hop. Thus, we have the culmination of what happened in 2013. We're literally in the 55-year history of the Hot 100. We've never had a situation where not a single lead black artist has ever topped or has not topped the Hot 100.
Before we get into picking your brain about this, because I think we all have a bunch of questions, why don't we just listen to a little montage of some of the songs that topped the charts this year. So the obvious ones are Blurred Lines by Robin Thicke. Morris Thrift Shop. I got a big, I'm just pumped. I bought some from a thrift shop. Ice on the fringe is so damn frosty. The people like, damn, that's a cold ass honky. We have Royals by Lorde. Crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royals. So coming out of that, you know, those are all good songs. I mean, I like those songs.
Sure, right.
Is 1 year of this trend a problem? I think we can all agree that if this were to go on for 20 years, we'd have something slightly different to talk about. But should 1 year of an all-white topped Billboard Hot 100 be setting off alarm bells?
That's a fair question. The most pointed criticism I've received since I wrote this piece for Slate came from a longtime observer of radio and the charts, who pointed out that radio and pop music in general is a pendulum, and we've seen swings back and forth before. What's slightly ominous about this wave is that it feels like the culmination of something that's been building for several years. You know, it's fine that we now regard Eminem as a completely credible rapper. It's fine that we regard Justin Timberlake as a completely credible R&B singer. It would be folly to not count them as R&B. What's troubling, however, is that this to me is like an unironic version of Stephen Colbert's joke, "Oh, I don't see color." It's as if we've all decided that because we're living in, you know, what is fallaciously called the post-racial America, it's totally cool that the R&B music we're listening to is performed largely by white people. Mm-hmm. But it's leaving a lot on the cutting room floor. And that's the part that's beginning to trouble observers of popular music.
You know, interesting counterpoint to that would be that the rise of hip-hop, it rises up to global predominance in part because people who embraced rock and roll and then embraced punk rock couldn't imagine how their kids could rebel against that.
Right.
And their kids found a way to do it, right? I'm not talking about now more about the kind of white suburban consumer of hip-hop than the producer of hip-hop, right?
Right.
But teenagers need to feel as though the universe began with them and they discovered its true nature, and their music needs to reflect that back to them. And if your parents listened to Public Enemy or Drake or whatever, Jay-Z, believe me, like, your 13-year-old kid won't. I mean, maybe it's not now or 5 years, but and they'll find some completely bizarre back alley through which to repudiate it.
I mean, all right. Well, my question is, and maybe it's possible that I just don't understand the number-crunching data changes that you described well enough, but aren't we also just talking about the dissolution of the Billboard Hot 100 as a meaningful category and a very quickly changing definition of what a hit is? I mean, it seems sort of hard to mourn that we don't have the same, you know, diversity on our list of top 100 hits as in 2004 if that list is a completely different animal made up of utterly different data,
right?
And when I actually think about the cultural conversations of this year and the pop music that's sort of risen to the level of, you know, us talking about in this show, for example, it's Kanye West's Yeezus and it's Beyoncé's end of year album. And It just seems like maybe there aren't black artists at the top of the charts, but there's certainly black artists that are huge and dominant in the cultural conversation about pop music.
Well, I'll take your last comment first. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about what's happened to R&B and hip hop, particularly hip hop in the last couple of years, is it's become an album medium, which is something people probably weren't predicting 10 to 20 years ago when it seemed like a singles medium. Albums by African-American artists, particularly hip-hop albums, do very well. Several had number one albums in 2013. So on the album side, Jay-Z's not having a problem. Kanye West is not having a problem. However, what's sort of interesting about the charts right now is we are going through something of a renaissance, if not in terms of quality, at least in terms of variety, in top 40 music. I wrote a piece about a year ago in which I called what was happening on the top 40 the return of the monoculture. Monoculture is a term that music critics obsess over. It's the idea that we're all sharing the same songs. It's that Michael Jackson moment in the early 80s when everybody had Thriller, that moment when everybody had Purple Rain. And what you started to see in 2012, thanks to the democratizing force of things like YouTube, was that when we were all into Call Me Maybe, everybody was into Call Me Maybe. And so there was a unified sense that there was a variety of stuff on pop radio, that we were all sharing it, that a song could have a folk backbeat, or it could have folk underpinnings, or it could have a hip-hop beat or an EDM beat. That's wonderful. The open question, which I'm wrestling with in this piece, is why, when we have so many shared songs, such variety, and such an array of different sounds on the chart, are songs by black artists the ones that are failing to rise to the top of the heap? That's the part that seems, if not conclusive, at least somewhat ominous.
Okay. Well, Chris Malanthi is a chartologist and a music critic and a contributor to Slate. His piece on Slate is in the Music Club 2013 edition. It's entry number 6, the number of black acts that have topped the Billboard Hot 100 this year, 0. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was a terrific fun.
Thank you so much.
All right, well, now is the moment in our program where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you have, Dana?
I'm sending Steven to the top of the pops with his hit song.
That's
Dana.
Very catchy.
Yeah.
Like now
that?
I'm on the spot. I can't live up to my introduction. I'm going to endorse the blog of a writer whose name I'm about to mispronounce tragically. It's, I believe, Steven Cusisto. His last name is spelled Cuusisto. And I discovered Steven Cusisto through HuffPo, where he had a blog for a while, but then found his own blog, which is StephenCusisto.com. And he is a poet and a writer who's been blind since birth and who writes a lot about blindness and about disability activism, but also just writes about his daily experience in a wonderful way. He has a new book of poems, relatively new book of poems, called Letters to Borges. He has a book called Planet of the Blind. He has a couple memoirs about growing up blind. But his blog is just fun to read for pure linguistic purposes. He writes in this very dense, elusive, poetic language. He writes things about his connection with his guide dog and his experience on nature walks and just sort of the experience of being, you know, a blind poet in contemporary America. And he's fascinating. It's a great blog.
That sounds amazing. We will, of course, link to it on the show page. Julia.
If you are looking for a calendar, calendars on Etsy. So I'm not a big Etsy shopper. I feel like Etsy is sort of a punchline sometimes of like the craft renaissance, and you can go buy like crocheted iPhone cozies or whatever. But I find it difficult to find calendars that I like and think are beautiful out in the world. People don't sell them. You can't tell from the internet whether the paper stock is going to be any good. And if you search either just calendars, 2014 calendars, or sometimes you can do a little inadvertent quality control by doing 2014 letterpress calendars. The letterpress artists tend to have good taste, I find. There's like an array of beautiful stuff on there. I think some of it's discounted now because we're already 2 weeks into 2014. And you can just find like great stuff to put on your desk that makes it a little bit more beautiful than it would be otherwise. On Etsy, one shop that I like in particular is called One Canoe Two. They have good stuff.
Okay, so I'm going to endorse, this is one of those, do I like it or don't I like it? I need the listeners to tell me, principally June Thomas. But I've started watching on Netflix, a French TV show called, the English title is Spiral, and the French title is Engrenage. You can also email in and tell me how to pronounce Engrenage. But it's a French crime drama. It's kind of a procedural. At a bare minimum, what I love about it is you see how incredibly weird and different this version of the continental justice system is from our adversarial system. It's a much less adversarial and much more kind of paternal/patriarchal system. The whole investigation is presided over by the judge who will be hearing the case. It's just so European. It's so deeply European. And what I've been told is there are things I just love about the show unreservedly, but what I've been told is that it gets even better in the second season. There are things about the show that do fill me with reservations, so I just need you to email in and tell me whether I like it. I should have said, by the way, this show's not subtitled. It's pas de sous-titres. So one needs to connaisser le français in order to
comprendre l'engrenage.
There we go. So there you go. Oh, my Lord. Well, that's our show, I guess. Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Julia, as always, a complete pleasure.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Volo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.